Welcome back. Tonight we're going to talk about how you don't have genuine assent in a contract. You don't have a contract. You don't have an agreement where there is deception involved, fraud, in the contract, or where there is pressure put on one of the parties to make the agreement, in which case you didn't make it out of your own free will. Last lectures, we opened up this area of contracts, capacity, and assent with contractual capacity. We talked about how minors and incompetents and people who are intoxicated don't have capacity to contract. You have status and capacity with people like minors or people who have been adjudicated as incompetent because of mental disease or defect. And you have situational or factual incapacity with people who are intoxicated or people who are temporarily mentally ill because they're not on their medication and can get better. People without capacity to contract either don't know that it's a contract or cannot understand the terms. And as a result, they don't have the ability to exercise genuine assent to the contract. Excuse me. Then we talked in our very last lecture about mistake. If there is a mistake in the contract, and it's not what the parties thought it was, then how can you agree to something when it's something different than what you thought it was? That's not a perception. A mistake is not a perception in the contract. That's an interpretation of the contract. But if you thought it said something differently than what the contract actually says, with unilateral mistakes, remember that generally is not a standard for rescission, meaning a cancellation of the contract or reformation, rewriting the contract by a court to get it where you thought it was. The exception on a unilateral mistake, where the courts do say that a unilateral mistake, only you misunderstood what it was, is if the other party realized you were making that mistake and said nothing. Where there's a mutual mistake, where both parties think that a material area of the contract, something that was important to the contract, important to its terms, was mistaken, that is grounds for rescission or for reformation, to write it back to where both parties thought they had an agreement. And with transcription errors, that's when it's taken either from an oral agreement or from a manuscript where they write it out, handwrite it, and in the final typewritten printed contract, it doesn't reflect what the agreement was. That is also ability to either have reformation or reform. When the court generally, these transcription errors, as we said, generally looks at it as a reform process because there was a contract that both parties agreed to, and they need to put it back into the format where it was agreed to. So they just basically rewrite the contract to put it in where it should have been, had that mistake in the printing or transcription not taking place. Tonight we're going to talk about deception or pressure, whereby there was a intentional misrepresentation or fraud or non-disclosure in the contract that led someone to feel that their contract has to be agreed when they really don't want it. That takes away the genuine assent because the person did not, where you have deception or pressure, duress, things like that. That takes it away from the genuine assent because they don't use their free will and they're pressured into doing it. They're like the old Godfather movie, that your brains are your signature on the contract. Well, guess what? That's not much of a choice. And as a result of that, they agree to it, but it's not something they wanted to agree to because they were forced into it. So there is no genuine assent. And after tonight's lecture, we're going to go into our case and talk about duress and the free will to contract. Okay. We're going to talk about deception and pressure. We're going to talk about intentional misrepresentation and fraud. We're going to talk about negligent misrepresentation. We're going to talk about non-disclosure. And lastly, we're going to talk about duress. Remember, it all comes back to the definition of what a contract is. It's an agreement between two or more parties creating obligations that are enforceable. And the bottom line on this with respect to deception and pressure is that it's an agreement. And that agreement's got to be made of your own free will. And where it's not, then it really isn't an agreement. It's an agreement between competent parties based on genuine assent. And again, when you have a deception or pressure in the agreeing of the contract, there is no genuine assent because you're not really agreeing to the contract. You're being forced to. Supported by consideration. Again, we're going to get into that in future lectures. That is a monetary payment or some other promise in return for it. That's the reciprocal nature of the duties and obligations of the contract. It's got to be for a lawful purpose, and it's got to be in legal format. Again, this issue of deception and pressure, the whole reasoning behind it is the fact that you need genuine assent. An agreement, approval, or permission that is authentic. It's real. It has the quality of what it's purported to be. A contract which is based on deception or on pressure doesn't have that. And there is no genuine assent because the contract to which the parties are entering is not what they believed it to be, or because of deception, it's not what they thought it was, or they were forced into it against their free will to enter it. So either one removes the essential element of true assent, genuine assent. Oop. I don't know how that happened. Sorry. Okay. What are the areas of deception or pressure? First, you have intentional misrepresentation. That's an act of intentionally or purposefully making a false or misleading assertion and with the intent to deceive you. So I say that this contract contains something, but it doesn't. Or I say that that's not in the contract, then it actually is. I'm intentionally, in order to induce you to sign it. And as a result of that, that intentional misrepresentation removes genuine assent. Fraud takes that a further step because it's an intentional misrepresentation of a material fact made for the purposes of inducing you to sign the contract. So you have to have all of those elements in fraud. There's a scienter requirement, meaning I am doing that to harm you, to hurt you. There's got to be actual harm in order for fraud to take place. Excuse me. As opposed to intentional misrepresentation, which occurs with an intentional misrepresentation or within fraud, you also have negligent misrepresentations. That means it's careless or inadvertent, but it's still a misrepresentation. I should have read the contract, but I'm telling you, oh, it's in there because I don't take the time to read that, and it's actually not. So one is purposeful, that I know that it's not in there, and I tell you that it is. The other one is I just don't take the care to recognize what you're asking me, and I represent to you something that's not true. With non-disclosure, there is the failure or the refusal to reveal something that might be or is required to be revealed. Now, generally, parties to a contract are not required to reveal or interpret things for the other party. That being said, there are certain times when, to give you an example, I'm selling my house and they ask for information on the roof and I don't give it to them. That's an intentional concealing. And the reason I don't give it to them, I don't say that it's a brand new roof, but I don't show them that the roof is actually 30 years old. So under certain circumstances, you're required to disclose. And when you fail to do that, that's called non-disclosure. Undue influence. That's the improper use of the trust or power that I have. Either I'm in a legal representational capacity, like a lawyer or doctor or nurse or an accountant of someone, and I deprive the person of their free will because I'm giving them representation, but I'm taking advantage of them through that. Or when you have a relationship with the person, like a spouse or a parent, and they take advantage of that other party. That's undue influence. They are in a position of trust and they misuse that trust to get the person to contract. Duress is when a threat is actually made. That's your brains or your signature on the contract. You actually threaten the person so that they will agree to the contract. Again, that removes genuine assent too. And duress could be a physical threat. I'm going to kill you unless you sign it. Or it could be a economic one saying, I hold your mortgage to your house. And if you don't sign this contract, rest assured that I'm going to call in that mortgage. That's economic duress. Either one of those duresses will allow you to have duress in the requirement of getting that assent in the contract, and the contract can thereby be canceled. And lastly is unconscionability. That's when the terms of the contract are so unfair. They're not just unfair, they're so unfair as to shock the conscience of the court. And when you have that unconscionability, the court steps in and says, this contract is obscene. It's just so unfair that a normal human being wouldn't enter in it. And as a result of that, we're going to be able to either provide rescission, that means cancellation, or reformation. We're going to rewrite the terms of the contract to make it more fair. Unconscionability, unlike the other issues, are an equitable resort. Remember, equity is fundamental fairness. It's not a issue of dollars and cents. It's a fairness doctrine, not a legal doctrine. The law is obviously concerned about facts and money. Okay. Let's start with the first one. Intentional misrepresentation is where a party to a contract intentionally or purposely makes a false or misleading assertion about something relevant to or contained within the contract with the intent to deceive the other party of the contract. So they say something is in there that it's not, or they say something's not in there that it is, they say that it has a different meaning for the purposes of deceiving the person. They're trying to pull the wool over their eyes. Such intentional misrepresentation is seen to remove the genuine assent because they're relying on what the party says, not on what the contract is, believing it to be true, and forming an untrue basis of their understanding. So as a result of that misrepresentation, which was done purposefully by the other party, then that's what removes the genuine assent. Now, remember, this is not the same as fraud. It's an element of fraud, but it's not fraud because fraud goes further than that. We'll talk about that in a minute. But although intentional misrepresentation is an element of fraud, alone by itself, it is not fraud, as it lacks some of the other requirements, principally what we will call scienter, that fraud requires. Intentional misrepresentation is not your opinion. It's not puffery. To give you an example, I'm trying to sell you my house, and I say, this is the greatest house ever. I love this house. It's so wonderful. Isn't this the most beautiful house you've ever seen? That is my opinion. It's exaggeration. It's puffery, but it's not an intentional misrepresentation. Okay? You can argue that, yes, it's not the greatest house in the history of the universe. You can argue that it's not the most beautiful house ever, but that's a person's individual, inflated, exaggerated perception. That is not an intentional misrepresentation. If, on the other hand, I tell you that this house has an annual heating cost of $500 a month and it's really $2,000, that's an intentional misrepresentation because I'm telling you something that is not true and I'm intentionally telling you that lie. An intentional misrepresentation is grounds for rescission. That means the contract is thereby voidable. So that the party that relies on this intentional representation thereby can go to the court and say, I want out. They told me something that isn't true. It's a material fact. And as a result of that, I don't want to do it. So intentional misrepresentation, all of these items which relate to deception and pressure, generally do not, the law does not favor that. The law does not like that. They want people to be honest. They want them to be honorable, particularly in contracts, because it requires two parties to agree on things. Remember, the courts like contracts because it allows two parties to work something out themselves. But where there is deception, where there's pressure, that really doesn't happen because you have a circumstance where someone is either misleading them intentionally or negligently, and they're basing their intent on it, or somebody's coercing that agreement. In those cases, the law doesn't like it. So with intentional misrepresentation, the contract is voidable by the party who gets misled. Now, fraud is even worse than intentional misrepresentation. And intentional misrepresentation is really bad, but fraud is even worse. Fraud is where one party to the contract intentionally and purposefully makes a false misleading assertion about a material fact contained in the contract for the purposes of inducing the other party to their detriment. It's not just that the fact that I make a misrepresentation. It's got to be material. It means it's got to be meaningful. It's got to be for the purpose of getting you to agree to it. That's why I make that fraudulent misrepresentation. And I have to do it for the purposes of harming you. That's why I'm doing it. I know that when I turn around and say to you that I'm only paying $500 a month in my heating bill, that you're going to actually pay that $2,000 a month that I'm actually paying. But I want you to buy the house so I don't care, and it'll end up hurting you. And I know that and do it anyway. This removes genuine assent. Fraud always does. Now, to qualify for fraud, as opposed to intentional misrepresentation, the misrepresentation must be made with deliberate, dishonest intent, and the person making it must not only know that it's false and must intend for it to induce the other party to enter the contract, but they also must know that it's going to cause that other party harm. This is what is known as scienter. Scienter is a Latin term, meaning that you're intentionally misrepresenting something for the purposes of harming someone. And fraud only arises when there's a false representation of a material fact with knowledge of the falsity, intent to induce the other party, and that the contract was relied upon to that person's injury. You have to prove harm in order to prove fraud, because if it's not a material fact, if you weren't harmed by it, that's not fraud. And for the individual to recover damages, because you can not only recover and gain rescission, that means cancellation of the contract, but you can also recover both punitive and actual damages under fraud. Those are punishment. Punitive damages are punishment damages for the actual losses suffered, and as well as punishment for fraud when it's gross and oppressive. Well, to do that, you have to show you were harmed. And without the harm, there is no fraud. There may be intentional misrepresentation, but without the harm, there's no fraud. And fraud is always a grounds for rescission, as well as damages that you suffer. Now, what about negligent misrepresentation? That's not where you intentionally deceive. It's where you are careless or inadvertently deceived. You say, as somebody asks you, what are your heating bills? And you say, I don't know, $500 a month. And you don't check on it. And you don't actually remember what it is. You're not intentionally deceiving them, but you never went back. And the last time you remember paying a heating bill was 30 years ago, and it was $500 a month. Well, in the 30 years since, it's gone up to $2,000 a month. You didn't intentionally deceive them, but you didn't take the care to go through and check the most recent bills to understand how much it was. This is not the same as fraud, because you're not doing it to harm them. You're just not taking the care that you need to answer their question. And when a negligent misrepresentation of a material fact that the listener relies on results in harm, the contract's voidable and you thereby have grounds for rescission of that contract. Next, we have non-disclosure. What is non-disclosure? Non-disclosure is when one party to a contract fails to disclose something relevant to or contained in the contract that they have to disclose. And I underscore that last part, because ordinarily a party to a contract has no duty whatsoever to volunteer information to the other party. You're not that other party's representative. As a matter of fact, to some degree, you're their adversary because you're on the other side of the agreement. So you have no duty to volunteer information. But there are certain circumstances when, because of a confidential relationship or because there's active concealment, you're hiding something, that you do have a legal duty to disclose. Sometimes that you have that duty under law. To give you an example, there's certain things when you go to buy real property that the law requires the seller to disclose to the buyer. They're required to. And if you don't do that, that is considered to be a breach of the law. Okay, it's the nature of the issue that is covered there. So when you are required by law to disclose something, or because you have a confidential relationship with that person, that you have to disclose it by means of another contract that you're with them, or when the non-disclosure consists of an act of concealment, you hide it from that person. Let's say that person turns around and is interested in the foundation of the house and you have all the stuff that you have for your backyard all over the foundation. You know, you have wheelbarrows and garbage cans and everything, so they can't see the foundation, and you pile all that stuff up there so they can't see the foundation. Well, that's not just non-disclosure. You're not telling them about the foundation. That's hiding the condition of the foundation so that it's active concealment. When those things happen, the contract is voidable by the person who gets harmed. And in specific instances, non-disclosure is grounds for rescission. Remember, you need one of those three things to happen. It's required to be disclosed by law, or because of a confidential relationship you maintain with the person who's required to tell you, or they actively conceal it. They don't just not tell you, they hide the issue. And as a result, so you can't learn it. And as a result, that can allow for the contract being voidable and rescission happening. Next, we're going to get, we talked about deception. We talked about intentional misrepresentation. We talked about fraud. We talked about negligent misrepresentation. We talked about non-disclosure. Those are the deception sides of the contract, which don't lead to genuine assent. The next step is relating to pressure. It's not that you don't know what's going on in the contract or that you don't fully know what's going on in the contract. You generally have an idea, but somebody is pushing you, removing your free will to provide that genuine assent. The first one is undue influence. Undue influence is where one of the party to a contract employs an improper use of power or trust that they have with the other party to remove their free will and their self-judgment and substitutes the initiatives of that other party for them. So, you know, if I'm a parent and I'm selling my child, my home, and I say, don't worry, that this is the best for you. You need to do this. And I exert my pressure as a parent on that child. And later, I really screwed my child to my best interest. Guess what? That is something that a contract can be rescinded for. If you are an attorney or a accountant, and your accountant has the contract with you, and they're saying, believe me, I always take care of your financial best interests. Sign this contract. I'm giving you good advice. And it turns out to be horrible advice, that it's only benefiting that accountant or that lawyer or that doctor, someone with whom you have that confidential relationship. Undue influence requires that confidential relationship because you have to have power over that other person or an element of trust in that other person. So when you have those, that means that you can exert your will for your benefit and to the other person's detriment. Those contracts are voidable because the law doesn't like the fact that you took advantage of that position of power and that position of trust to unduly influence and unfairly influence that other party of the contract. Duress. Duress is when you physically or economically threaten the person. If you do not do that contract, we're going to beat you up with a baseball bat. If you don't sign that contract, we're going to kill you, or we're going to kill your mother, or we're going to kill your dog, okay? That is a physical duress. We're going to cause violence or harm to you or someone you care about. And as a result, that's not your free will. They're getting you to execute that contract based on that threat, not upon your free will and your desire to do that and give your genuine assent. You also can have economic duress. As we said before, I hold your mortgage to your property, or I will tell you that that's economic duress is not something that you're allowed to do. Like, I'll give you an example. If I turn around and say, you and I have a contract on something outside of this contract, and I said, sign this contract, or I'm going to enforce my rights on my other contract. Well, guess what? You have a legal right to do that anyway. So where a person has a legal right to do something anyway, that's not duress, okay? But where they turn around and say, I hold your mortgage, and there is a clause in the mortgage that says in the event that you lack moral turpitude, I can call in the mortgage. Well, I'm gonna view this as a lack of moral turpitude if you don't sign this contract. Well, that is not true, and I'm using my power over you economically to do this. Or I'm your boss, and I'll turn around and say, sign this contract, or I'm gonna fire you. Well, even though you have the legal right to fire someone, you ordinarily would fire them only for cause or for some kind of misbehavior. It is over and above what you have a legal right to do. And you are turning around and you are exercising a right that you shouldn't in order to get a cent on this other contract. Where there is a threat of harm, and it's got to be a threat of harm, the contract's voidable. Lastly, unconscionability is an equitable relief, meaning it's an issue of fairness. This is where one party of the contract exerts such extreme unfairness in the contract that the other party lacks a meaningful choice. The contract is so one-sided, it's so unfair, and it's deemed as, quote, shockingly unfair, that it shocks the conscience of the court. When the court looks at it and says, this is horrendous, this is obscene, no normal human being would have agreed to this. So, and where it's so one-sided, it's to an equitable fairness doctrine is to prevent the oppression or unfair surprise. It's described as a combination of gross inequity of bargaining power combined with substantially unfair terms. Where the court finds it unconscionable, that means the contract is just so unfair that they can't say it's okay. They will generally reform it. Sometimes they will rescind it, putting the parties back to the status quo. But most of the time they'll reform it, that means rewrite it, and take out the unconscionability. If I miss a payment suddenly in a contract, if I miss a payment, I have to pay a 20,000% liquidated damages clause. Well, that's insane. Nobody requires that. And as a result of that, you have a circumstance where the courts will find it to be way too unfair. That's it for duress and pressure and power and the undue influence for this, where you have a contract that shouldn't be entered into because of misrepresentation or deception or pressure. So as a result of that, we're now going to go on to our case, and we'll see you next time. Thanks.